Good morning and welcome, good people. So, John, let's say I found my passion. Let's say that I know what I want to do for the rest of my life, and you're trying to tell me that, well, maybe I should try to start my own business. When do you decide what the next step should be? And when should I feel comfortable jumping out there so that I can do my passion every day and love life as you say I should? What's my next step? Great question. One of the things I tell people that is very important, especially if you're starting out working for someone, let's say it's the lemonade stand. You've worked that lemonade stand for, I don't know, maybe a year. And you think, hey, maybe I want to open my own lemonade stand. One of the things I am going to advise you to do is have the confidence and not be afraid to ask your current boss, your current manager, the person who's been there for a while, ask them the questions that you would love to know if you were going to be doing your own lemonade stand. One of the amazing things as an entrepreneur that helped me tremendously was that before I bought the mowing / landscape business, I was able to work that business. And because I was pretty close to my owner, I was able to ask him a lot of questions. I was able to find out what was the profits he was making. I was able to find out what was the costs on the equipment. I will be honest, he just didn't come out one day and say, hey, John, here's my financial statement. Here's my profit and loss statement. This is exactly what my business looks like. No, it wasn't that. But it was important for me to say, okay, hey, if I am going to start this business, what if he is going to pay me an hourly rate for the next 6 months or a year and I learn as much as I can? So I'm preparing myself and I'm doing my research to where, okay, when I jump into this business, I have a pretty good idea of what the pros and the cons are. We all will have our passions. We all will have this dream of, man, if I could do this, I would love to be my own boss. I would love to wake up every single morning and say, my day is dependent on me. I am in control. Control is one of those words that for some people, it's a bad word. For other people, it's, no, I made the choice that I want to be in control of my life today. Granted, when you have employees, sometimes that control changes, but that's okay. But there's a lot of times where you can work somewhere. You may find out 3 months after working there that, oh my gosh, I hate doing this. So you stop, you drop, and you go find another cool fire to put out. Sorry, I couldn't help. Basically, though, we all don't know exactly what our passions are going to be, or we may think we love doing this until we actually do it for a while. Our passions for many people, bankers hear this all the time. I want to start my business doing this. And well, why do you? Because I love this. And the banker is sitting there saying, you know, I'm glad you love this, but do you have any idea what it's going to take to run a business doing this? So one of my pieces of advice is if you can find your passion, work that passion for someone else and learn what it's going to take to make some money. Too many businesses go belly up because the passion is there, but the research, the intelligence is not. Anytime you think you want to do something, give yourself 6 months to a year, work for someone else. Don't be afraid to ask them questions. Don't be surprised if they don't want to give you all the answers, okay? Not every business owner out there was like me, who my best employees were the ones that were smart enough to go out and do their own thing. A lot of business owners aren't like that, because a lot of business owners don't want any more competition. That wasn't me. My job was to train, teach, teach, and teach some more. And my employees, who eventually went out and did their own thing, to this day are probably my favorite employees. And they're also the ones that I was most proud of, because they had the big C. They had the confidence to go out and do it. So you want to be a synthetic turf dealer? You want to sell synthetic turf? Is 22 years of playing with turf enough time to decide that if I wanted to do something silly and crazy, like build a quasi-private golf course using synthetic turf, is that something that after a long time of research, I feel more comfortable now than I would have probably 23 years ago or 15 years ago? Research your product, research your passion, research your business before you get into the business. And when you can research your business while being paid either a salary or an hourly rate, that is a win-win situation. So whether it's lemonade, landscaping, llamas, whatever you decide your passion is, try to do your very best by learning the process on someone else's dime. You are going to see things that happen on a daily basis that will make you say, oh my God, I want to raise llamas. It's the greatest thing. I can make so much money. And then Friday, you're going to see something that occurs that suddenly, I just lost $3,000 today because my llama did this. Research your business before you get into your business. Decide early, do I want to be the businessman that charges most of the customers 90% more than my competitors? In other words, do I want to go into this business and I want to be so well known that people say, you got to go with this guy, but you're going to spend a lot of money, but he's worth it? Usually those businessmen do pretty well. The other end of that is he's now selling llamas, but there's 15 other guys selling llamas, and his price for a llama is about the same as somebody else's. And no, John M. Schrader hasn't ever sold a llama in his life. I'm not even sure if I've been to a llama business. Research your business, and the best way to do that is work the business through someone else. And learn, why is it that businesses fail? But first, be confident to ask the question. All right, I'm very excited. For the next week, I'm going to be gone on a very fun fishing trip with a bunch of my good friends. We're heading down to the big lake, Lake Cumberland, somewhere in Tennessee. And I don't know, we're just going to have a blast. So I thought today, maybe we tell some fishing stories. Fishing stories are things that I've been around since the first time my father took me out fishing when I was probably about five. And I'm pretty sure most of my day was just getting the knots out of my line. But my father and I did a lot of fishing. And when I think back to my dad, I think of many riverbanks and some deep sea fishing boats and lakes where we just kind of hung out for a few hours. I thought it was all about the fishing. Later, I realized once I had sons, no, it's about being able to get away from mom and the sisters and giving ourselves some peace and quiet. So today, I'm going to tell you a few fishing stories. One of the fishing stories I have been told by my friends is the saddest fishing story they've ever heard. And it was kind of sad, but I'll let you decide. So after my father and I did a lot of fishing together, one of the best times we had was a gentleman by the name of Ham Fisher. We would go down to Kentucky Lake. Ham had a boat. It was a nice, large, flat fishing boat, probably 18 feet long, 8 feet wide. We would go up to the dam at Kentucky Lake, and we would fish for blue cat most of the day. And what we loved about it was I'd get up 4 o'clock in the morning. I was young enough that, shoot, I'd just sleep all the way down. It was about a 2-hour drive. And most of the time, we would come home with a big fishing bag of catfish. Usually, we would try to clean them down there. But fishing with these two gentlemen, my father and Mr. Fisher, was, gosh, it was a boy's dream. Being below the dam with all these other boats and seeing people pulling in huge catfish, seeing the guys over on the side actually snagging spoonbill catfish. So it just one day blew my mind when my father came to me and said, hey, good news. I found a boat. I think we're going to be able to have our own boat. Now, granted, I never really thought of us as a poor family because we did a lot of fun things. We had a house very close to the grade school and the high school I went to. But I also knew we weren't the richest in the neighborhood. But the time we spent together, in my opinion, as a family, we were wealthy beyond our dreams. And when my father told me, and I was probably 7, 8, maybe 10 years old at this time, my father told me that we are going to be able to have our own fishing boat. I had a hard time believing that. But sure enough, that Friday, my dad is pulling behind our station wagon a trailer with a boat that was probably, oh, I'll bet it was at least 13 to 14 feet long. It was a wooden boat, kind of boat that, I don't know, maybe Ernest Hemingway would have written about. But the boat needed some work. But here I was with my dad in our front yard, and we had a boat. Even the neighbors couldn't believe it. So for the next 5 to 6 weeks, we are spending every evening when my dad got home, we are spending time putting this boat together. There were areas where we had to replace boards. There were certainly the need to sand this whole thing down. We also were going to have to paint it with at least 3 or 4 coats of paint. But by God, John and his dad now had a boat that we could go anywhere we wanted and we could fish anytime we wanted. By week 5, we're pretty much done with the boat. I remember my dad even saying, what do we want to call this boat? The USS Minnow? Nah, I think Gilligan took that one. The USS Wasp? No, that was an aircraft carrier that my father was on in the Navy. So, you know, the big decision was, what are we going to call this boat? My dad said, hey, you know what? Let's just think about it. Something will come to mind. The only thing was that now that the boat was ready, my dad felt like we really needed to take the boat out and do like a test, you know, the test voyage, you know, see if it's completely and totally sound. Is there any leaks? We had oars with this thing. We really just wanted to finally get this boat out on the water, just the two of us. Oh, wait, my sister wants to come, Joni. She's younger. She wants to go with us. And so we decide on a Saturday, there was a lake very close to our house. It was kind of a public lake, I guess you would call it. It was an area between two very popular roads, Diamond Avenue and St. Joe Avenue. And we decided, hey, we're just going to take this boat out for a half an hour. We're going to see if it's seaworthy. And I could not sleep Friday night because I was going to be in our own boat for the first time in my life. The Schraders were, man, we were being talked about around the neighborhood. So the next morning, as we get ready to leave, I decided, hey, Dad, let me bring this BB gun with me if I can, because, you know, at this age, I think I was able to shoot the BB gun every once in a while, which makes me think maybe I was closer to 10. My sister wanted to come along, so she came. Joni was 2 years younger than me, and we proceed to take the boat to the lake. We get to the lake, and as we put the boat into the water, we back it up. My sister and I are in the boat. I've got my BB gun ready to shoot into the water or whatever I think I'm going to shoot at. And my father is holding the boat, getting ready to get into the boat. And as he does, he puts the oars in place. And all of a sudden, my emotions are so high as we pull ourselves away from the shore. We are in the boat, which means we are going to be fishing soon, which means I am now independent of all these other people that I could only go in their boats if they asked me. As my father pulls away from the shore about 8 to 9 feet, we're the only ones on this lake. It's probably no more than a couple acres. And it's in a place where there really aren't any people other than you can see the cars going back and forth and by. But as my father gets about 8 to 10 feet from shore, a sheriff's car pulls up. That's interesting. And in fact, the sheriff's car doesn't just pull up. The sheriff car puts his lights on. Actually, I thought that was kind of cool. Like, hey, you know, I thought he was maybe there to congratulate us on our new boat. I always was a little gullible. However, I looked at my father's face because he was looking right at me because now he was oaring back to shore. And I could see on my father's face that maybe he wasn't here to congratulate us. As we pull up to shore, Joni and I still continue to sit in the boat. My dad ties the boat off, and the sheriff asks him to come back to sit in his car. I thought that was awful nice of him. And so for the next 30 to 40 minutes, which it really seemed more like an hour and a half, my sister and I are sitting in the boat. I think I actually took and shot the BB gun a couple times at something in the water. And with that, the door opens to the patrol car. My father works out and he's got a bunch of papers in his hand. He comes to the boat and I'm kind of smiling. So, Dad, how long can we boat here? And he suddenly informs me, we can't boat here, John. We're not able to boat here. I could tell by the tone in his voice. I could tell by the face that this suddenly wonderful, amazing, beautiful morning had maybe taken a strange turn. An hour later, we're home, and as we're walking inside to the kitchen, and I'm asking Dad questions that he just doesn't want to answer a whole lot of. My mom comes downstairs and asks how everything is, and is at that point that my dad says to me, John, why don't you and Joni go out inside and play for a little while? Oh, okay, sure, I'll do that. I think the 7 tickets went something like this. Illegally boating on public property that was not allowed. No life preservers in the boat. I believe this was 1970. Boat was not licensed. BB gun in possession of a minor. And 2 or 3 other things that my father did not do that created stress in the family. The thought my father had was this was going to be a 20-minute moment to see if the boat leaked. If the boat didn't leak, we would then proceed to do things like probably get life preservers, and we would get licenses, and we would get it registered, and we would find out the rules and this and this and this. However, as he went to court a few weeks later, and he did inform us that he was the very last person, he comes home to inform us of just how much the tickets were going to cost. Once again, he let me and my sister and my other siblings, he told us to go out and play somewhere. And within a few hours later, my father comes out to let me know that because of the extreme fines for all these things we didn't do well, and we didn't have much money saved, there was only one way we could pay the tickets. Yeah. Yeah. We had to sell the boat. I'm not really sure if that was my father's idea or if that was my mother's demand or expectation, but sure enough, my amazing fishing boat that I saw in the future where I was going to catch the biggest fish, the most fish, was the boat I never even got to name. Maybe I could have named it the USS Sold, S-O-L-D. We sold the boat to pay for the tickets because we didn't have the money to pay for the tickets on its virgin flight, float, whatever you want to call it. I mean, even the Titanic got to go out for a few days. I learned a lot then about our family's financial situation. I learned a lot then about the rule of law. To this day, my father never blamed the police officers. No, my father just admitted, you know what, I should have thought through this. My father admitted that we thought what this 20 minutes was going to do, the what's the possibility that we're going to attract attention, and then I guess we realized that never had we ever seen a boat on this lake. But my boat, my adventure, my USS Minnow was about 8 feet offshore. I think one of the funny parts, and I can't remember what this ticket cost because I never asked, the whole thing about the BB gun, you know, the next time you let your son or daughter shoot a BB gun, make sure it's on your own property. Okay, so the saddest fishing story. Let's go to the funnest fishing story. I love to deep sea fish. And one of the great reasons of deep sea fishing is I have always said all my life, you never know what you're going to catch. If you're in a river or a lake around here, yeah, if you're having a great, 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 great day, you're going to catch a 30, 40, 50, 60 pound blue cat. You're going to catch a 4 or 5 pound bass. You're going to maybe catch a pound and a half bluegill. The thing about fishing in the ocean is you never know what's going to be on your line. And I think that's why deep sea fishing to me today is still one of my greatest passions. The deep sea fishing, along with being a scuba diver, allows me not only to see what can I catch, but it allows me to go down into the depths of the ocean and to also see exactly how these schools of fish work, to see in a huge area of coral around Cozumel, the different groups, the types of fish. Yeah, there are some of those people out there saying, wait a second, so you're a scuba diver, which you love, but you also love catching fish and eating fish. And so, you know, for some of you out there listening to this, that may be a conflict of interest. That's okay. So I'm fishing one day off the shores of Destin. For many years, my family went down to Destin. Destin started out as a small village, and it was a very successful fishing village for a lot of reasons I don't want to get into now. But as I'm fishing, I would love to go out on the 10 or 12 hour trips. Red snapper, amberjack, grouper, just about every different kind of fish you could imagine, depending on the time of year, depending on how far we were going out, depending on the bait. Occasionally, gosh, would we hook into a sailfish? Would we hook into a wahoo? But the beautiful thing about deep sea fishing is, one, the water's so clear, you get to see some of this fish 30 and 40 feet before you even get to the boat because of the clarity of the water. But most of my fish was bottom fishing, where we would go out and we would drop our lines maybe 100, 200, 250 feet, and you'd see what would bite. One day while we were fishing, our lines were all out. Usually we were in a boat with five or six other fishermen. And as our lines were out, the captain calls down to us, "Okay, everyone, hold on to your pose." "Okay, what's going on, Captain?" "I think, I'm positive, a whale shark has just swam under our boat." I haven't seen a whale shark in my entire life, but as this huge shadow goes under our boat, all four of our lines start going out because this whale shark is so large, it is now getting a little bit, not tangled, but it's just running through our lines. The captain, "Hold on to your pose. Everyone, hold on to your pose, because you're going to have the fight of your life for just a little bit." I have now hooked into a whale shark. And I don't know, 30 feet long, maybe 10 feet wide, 30 feet under the water. This was by far, I am pretty sure, without question, the largest fish I had ever hooked into. The likelihood of me landing this fish was about as likely as me hitting the lottery. And that hasn't happened yet either. But for the next 90 seconds, my string is screaming, which if you're a fisherman, it's one of the greatest sounds you ever hear. Realizing I am now holding on to a 30-foot whale shark with the only intention of don't let this thing pull the pole out of your hands. And it didn't. And sure enough, as the captain and the first mate told me, he's just going to break the line when he decides to break the line. And he broke the line. I could fish in the Ohio River all the days of my life. I could fish in the great streams out west. I could fish in the Great Lakes. For a moment, I almost felt like Jonah, the whale. Even though I really wasn't eaten, I still was close enough. This is why I like deep sea fishing, because I had a fish story that few could tell. And for 90 seconds, all I can do is tell you it was well worth the money I spent that day. So this week, I'm getting to head out with my friends. We're going to do a lot of fishing. We're going to do a lot of eating. There will probably be a little bit of drinking, maybe at night. We'll play some poker. The place we're going to actually has some really awesome trails where we're going to take some 4x4s and some four-wheelers. But for 1 week, we are going to be able to come up with some amazing fish stories. But I promise you this, not a single one is going to touch the fish story of the whale shark. But that takes me to our next fish story. Many years later, when we would take our venture crew scuba diving in Cozumel, which I have a wonderful story to tell you sometime about our Cozumel trip of 2023, I had the opportunity to go out and dive with whale sharks. Whale sharks, there is a trail of thousands of miles that as these whale sharks migrate around the world, the people of Cancun are blessed that about 40 miles offshore, the whale sharks make their way through their ocean trek. I'd heard about this opportunity years earlier from a good friend of mine who went and actually snorkeled with the whale sharks. So at this time in my life, I had the opportunity to finally maybe get up close and personal to one of the sharks, who knows, that maybe I hooked a long time ago. Most likely not. But literally thousands of whale sharks go through this channel. And it was pretty cool as we were putting the day together, which it took us about 12 hours to make this happen. There were some interesting facts and there were some interesting rules. Rule number one, you cannot and will not be able to wear any type of suntan lotion, suntan spray, because these areas where we are going to be snorkeling with the whale shark, we want it to be the purest of pure water. The good analogy they gave me was, imagine if you were having a nice big salad that you were ready to eat, and right before you ate it, we sprayed a whole bunch of suntan lotion on your salad. Would you still eat your salad? I could work with that. The other thing is, you cannot touch a whale shark. Well, what if they touch you? They won't touch you. They know exactly where they're at. But if you can get lucky enough to get close enough to a whale shark, you just have to watch it. Do not reach out and touch it. Federal, international fines, I don't know, thousands of dollars. What was really cool was as we took off from the Cancun area, we knew that we would be seeing potentially the whale sharks at mile 30 to mile, say, 50. The channel that these humongous beasts go through is a very narrow, small segment of the ocean. So as we took off that day and we were in a boat with six other people, three of them I knew, three others, one from England, we were going out and we realized later that there was a 50-50 chance that we may get to actually snorkel and swim with the whale sharks. You do not scuba dive. There are so many rules that you have to be aware of. And they basically tried to prepare us by saying, okay, gentlemen, ladies, here's what's going to happen. If we see, when we see the whale shark, we are going to position the boat to where you're going to be able to jump off of the boat. And you're going to have to do your very best to swim next to, in front of, behind the whale sharks that are coming through here. Average lengths are going to be 20 to 30 feet. If we're lucky, we'll see a 40-foot whale shark. So as we're driving out, which was 2 hours of some pretty rough seas, we're not exactly sure when are we going to see the whale sharks, how will we see them. And the captain and the first mate, wonderful guys, you're going to see the back fin off the tail. You're going to see the dorsal fin. And it's going to get a little crazy once we see them. What did he mean by that? Crazy. What do you mean crazy? Are they going to be eating us? Oh, by the way, the title of this day is Only One Boat Sank. Okay? So if you're referencing this story on my website, look up Only One Boat Sank This Day. Sure enough, at about mile 42, word comes out that they found the pod. And finding the pod now means that here we were out in the ocean by ourselves in a boat. Now that we've found the pod, within about 20 minutes, imagine 40 boats of different sizes all converging around 4 to 5 whale sharks. And yes, these whale sharks were near the surface. I don't know how often you guys have been out on the ocean, how often you've been boating, but imagine if you would 40 boats with an average of anywhere from 7 to 10 people per boat, all jockeying into position to try to get close enough that you now can jump off of the boat and hopefully get to swim with one of the greatest creatures on this earth. The craziness is multifolded. You only get 2 opportunities to actually jump off the boat to be able to swim with the whale shark. And remember, we're in an area of drift where the whale shark He is not really looking like he's going very fast. But once you jump in and you try to keep up with this whale shark, yeah, Mark Spitz would be impressed. But here you are, you've got all of these boats in a very small area with amazing captains who are now going and trying to position, jockeying the boat close enough to where either you have to jump off the side to where you're going to be beside the whale shark, which isn't really good. Or if you don't jump soon enough, you're going to be behind the whale shark, which all you're going to do is wave. Or if you're really lucky, you're going to be able to jump in the front of the whale shark and watch him come to you. I didn't understand initially when I signed the contract why you only got to jump in two times. But now that I see that this area of confusion, chaos, and all of the boats who are trying to now get literally hundreds of people into the water at specific times. No, you do not have 100 people all in the water around one whale shark. No, each boat knows, and many of these captains or fishing boat captains, they know that if we can send two or three boats in at a time and two people can jump off of each boat for each of these whale sharks, there's anywhere from maybe 6 to 8 people trying to swim next to these amazing beasts. My opportunity occurred. And being a pretty decent swimmer, being an experienced scuba diver, and have been spending hours and hours and hours of my life with a snorkel and fins and all that good stuff, I was able to jump into the water about 15 feet away from this particular shark. He was probably, I am guessing, the captain said, between 28 and 30 feet long. When I jumped into the water, imagine being a little kid for the first time in a candy store. Imagine being a little kid in a swimming pool for the first time where you are almost beside yourself. I was beside the whale shark, and I learned very quickly that I swam as hard and as fast as I could for about 3 to 4 minutes. Being able to get, I would say, maybe close to 8 feet from the whale shark. People behind me who were in too late, people in front of me. But here I was at the age of 63. I am now swimming next to the animal that I hooked many, many, many years ago. Not the same animal, but they're probably related. After about 3 minutes, I am exhausted because you're literally swimming as fast as you can. I'm super exhausted. I come up, big smile on my face because I just swam with a whale shark. Got back in the boat, and as I'm in the boat, I am now just again amazed at the chaos of all of these boats trying to get their divers into the water. And it occurred to me, number one, just how amazing these captains were. Number two, how this really is not the safest thing in the world, and why, in fact, yep, when I was signing the waiver, it talked about the D word, and that's not for dog. But now I had another opportunity. There is one rule that if you jump both times and both times you are so far back, you do have an opportunity if the captain approves it. You do have a chance to jump a third time. But that's very rare. So sure enough, about a half an hour later, we have now jockeyed back into positions. Everyone else in the boat has now been in the water, and we're all telling the story about, wasn't that exciting? But now the captain says, guys, get ready. And I was actually diving with one of my friend's daughters, and we were going to have an opportunity to jump in about 30 to 40 feet in front of what was about a 40-foot whale shark. Now I'm really excited. He says, as you jump in, as this whale shark is coming towards you, you have to decide, do you want to get on the left side or the right side? All I knew was that now I am going to be in front of this magnificent creature, and I was going to have a much better dive this time because I was going to be able to swim longer with it. I was going to be able to pick up my own speed before the shark even gets to me. So as I jump in the water and I adjust my mask, he's starting to come towards me. And as I'm looking at him, I see something that surprised me. Sticking out of its mouth looked like it was about a 6-foot tongue. And with all the research of whale sharks I've done, and hasn't been all that much, I didn't think whale sharks had tongues. And the closer he got, the tongue was kind of flopping back and forth. And sure enough, I found out later, no, it's not the tongue. It was a lamprey eel. Some call it the dentist eel. This huge lamprey eel was literally inside the mouth of this whale shark and basically picking and chewing and eating the parts of the whale shark's mouth that he didn't want there. More about that later, but I am now in front of this whale shark whose mouth, imagine, is probably 6.5 feet wide. It looks like it's 2 to 2.5 feet high. And it looks like the kind of mouth that, yeah, if I stayed where I was, I could probably become in a cave of a whale shark. But that wasn't where I was going to go. Immediately, I decide I'm going to kick to the right of the shark. And as quickly and as hard and as fast as I can, I am now 4 feet to the right of the shark. I'm seeing eye to eye, and the eyes were humongously large. I'm now seeing near the neck area, which if it was a neck area, it's actually the part of the shark. And I see something very strange. I see these 3 large black striations, these lines that are right along the edge of the shark. No idea what they were, but I can tell you this, I was amazed and I'll always remember those striations. And so for the next 3 to 5 minutes, as fast and as hard as I could swim, I am now swimming 4 feet from this amazing creature. It felt surreal. I felt like I was in a dream. I felt like, wow, how lucky am I at this stage in my life to be in this position? As the shark again, he was just barely moving. His tail was barely moving back and forth, but that's all he needed for the propulsion to slowly swim past me. 5 minutes later, I came out of the water. The lady that was also on the boat from England later was able to show me some of the video she took of the whale shark. But here I was. What a fish story I now had to tell. Here I was, a guy who got to swim with the whale shark that years earlier he was able to hook. And years before that, he was the guy that couldn't even go out his first time on a fishing boat. Yeah, I guess we can call it the circle of life. But it's probably my 3 favorite fish stories. As usual, as I'm getting close to the end of this particular podcast, I'd like to reflect on a moment that I feel is important as I began my podcast. Like a good fish story, the first thing people ask is, are these stories true? And yes, they're true. They're fish stories that have taken me through a journey of my life that has brought me here today. And the opportunity for me to spend a week with my very close friends fishing, I'm really, really looking forward to. Because of time, unfortunately, the apology that I promised will probably need to come in our next podcast. With that being said, one real quick story that I'm going to share to leave you wondering more about me and why I am who I am, and how in the world does John come up with some of the strangest ideas. But throughout my life, I think one of the things I'm most excited about is some things have stuck with me for so long, and I always knew I would have an opportunity to hopefully figure them out. So since we're playing Fish Story today, here is my last story that has to do not necessarily with fish, but it is a hilarious story that deals with water. I'm 18 years old, and I am at a place called Lincoln City. Lincoln City was one of these amazing campgrounds that was where Lincoln, the president, grew up. This is the earlier days. They made it a state park. And Lincoln City was the one place that our family used to do a lot of camping. We did camping there many times with my cousins and with my friends. So Lincoln City also became the place where when I was hitting those ages, 16, 17, 18, you know, those ages where you're invincible, you pretty much control the world. And parents, they're just people that you got to talk to occasionally. But myself and about 10 of my friends, we used to hang out together. We'd go down to the beach. We were usually looking for the girls on the beach. Some of us still too shy to really go up and do a lot of talking. But it was that time in our lives where, as young men, it was a good place to be. One night, we're out walking around the lake and having a good time and telling wonderful stories and stupid jokes and being as sophomoric as sometimes we can. And if you realize, this was back in the early 70s. The 60s was still a very, very close memory. And as we're walking down along the lake, we start to smell the smell that would permeate through the air. Yeah, somebody was smoking pot. So as we work towards the smell, we see a gentleman. He looks like he's about 25 years old. Imagine your stereotypical hippie, the bell-bottom jeans, the long hair, the I don't give a care what I'm wearing. I'm loving life right now. And he's sitting right next to the lake. He's actually like on this rock and his feet are actually in the water. And as we come up to him, he acknowledges us and we're like, hey, man, what's going on? And he's like, hey, dudes, what's going on? You know, and we didn't know this guy from Adam, but we could tell you one thing. He was having a great time. He was loving life and we were still young enough and inquisitive enough. And what we noticed, it wasn't really what he was smoking, but he had a pack of matches. You know, the old matches, the stick matches. And he was taking these matches and he was striking the match and he was putting the match into the water. And as he did it, you heard that sound of the water putting the match out. And he was laughing. And sure enough, he'd light another match and he'd stick it in the water. Same thing. Each time he did that, he was laughing. Kenny, my confident best cousin friend, man, what are you doing? What are you doing with those matches? And why are you just lighting them and sticking them in the water? Oh, dude, I'm not drowned in the matches, man. He said, I'm drying up the lake. You're what? Yeah, man, I'm drying up the lake. Do you realize if I had enough matches that we could dry this lake up? Because every time I put a match in the water, there's less water in the lake. Okay. So let me get this right. In his world, which it's his world right now, in his world, he might be right. He might be right. He really is. He actually, in a controlled environment, that wisp of water that now has become that little foggy, whatever we want to call it, the lake actually has less water in it than it did before he put the match in. And for 45 years, every once in a while, it was usually when I would hear a song from the 60s or the 70s, my mind would go back to that moment in time and the hippie that was drying up the lake. And I said, you know, someday I'm going to play with his theory. And about 3 years ago, I finally got to. John M. Schrader's mind sometimes goes to, okay, John loves big numbers. I loved the millions, the trillions, the quadrillions, the quintillions, the sextillions. I loved thinking about big numbers and will share big numbers. But today, I finally got to play with a big number. Now, my first plan was to go with my friends from college who were all out walking the trails around Knoxville, Tennessee. And as I'm telling them and I'm sharing this story with them, and they've heard the story before back in the good old days in college, I'm like, boys, I'm ready to find out how many matches it would take for this guy in a perfect world to dry this lake up. And these friends are all looking at me like, you really are crazy, aren't you? But I had decided to take a thimble because I knew that if I had a thimble and I had enough matches, what would it take for me to dry up enough water in half of a thimble? Because throughout all these years of thinking about this, I'm like, you know what? This is a very simple math question. Being in aquatics all my life and learning that a cubic foot of water is what, like 7.25 gallons, something like that. I knew my biggest struggle was going to be finding something that I could put a little bit of water in, then I could multiply it and multiply it and multiply it and multiply. The problem was my friends, they wanted no part of this. They thought I was absolutely crazy. No, we have other things we need to talk about that are more important. So I literally had to go from that weekend to the next week. I came back to my house and called some of my really great fun friends, the kind of guys that, you know what? Yeah, love the story. How many matches would it take? And sure enough, about four of us were sitting around at a table. I've got my wife's thimble that she uses very rarely when she's sewing. But I filled this thimble up halfway, and with 42 matches, I could dry the water in the thimble. And now I had my numbers. So, before I leave, if you're bored and if you love math, pretend you've got a 5-acre lake. Look it up. How many cubic feet of water in a 5-acre lake? The lake is exactly, on average, 8 feet deep. So a 5-foot lake, 8 feet deep, in a controlled situation. And no, don't overthink this. Don't pretend, but what if it rains? Don't pretend of the humidity. In a perfect situation, if it took me 42 matches to dry up a half a thimble, and yeah, you're going to have to find a thimble that's similar to the kind I had. This weekend, if you want to have a little fun and you want to play with big numbers and you want to play with math, if it took 42 matches to dry up a half of a thimble, how many matches in a perfect world would that hippie have had to use that night to dry up Lincoln State Park? And it's a big number. It's a fun number once you start playing with it. And this is probably the time where many of you are saying, this guy, I really didn't see this kind of thing coming from this guy. But this is a pretty good example of the things that keep me laughing at night, laughing during the day, laughing with my friends who I eventually could send back to my college friends and say, hey, just out of curiosity, here's the number. And then when they realized we actually did figure it out. I love my country. I love my God. I love my family. And I love people. I love people because there's so many different people in the world that, yeah, someday you'll find somebody who's out there who's just as crazy as you are, that over a couple cold Bud Lights, we answered a 45-year question. of how many matches that guy that night would have had to strike to dry up the lake. Wish me well on my fishing trip. Hopefully I'll have some really good stories when I come back. I promise you this, I will be so hoarse from laughing and so hoarse from telling stories. But here's one thing I am pretty darn sure. No matter how long I fish in Lake Cumberland, I really don't think I am going to hook into a whale shark. But this world is a crazy world. You never know. And with that being said, my friends, again, thank you for tuning in today. Be talking to you all very soon. Have a great weekend. And if you get out fishing, have some fun. And if you see a boat out there and you see a sheriff's car with his lights on, realize that not every fishing trip ends well. Take care, my friends. Enjoy your day.